The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program featuring interviews with local and national authors of fiction and nonfiction. I'm your host this week, Leanne Kranz. In the studio this morning, we are joined by Portland writer Rob Yardoumian, here to discuss his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, which is accompanied by a music CD called Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned, original songs inspired by the novel, written and performed by Rob. This novel is a rock and roll story through and through. A band breaks up after blowing their debut gig at CBGB, a fateful night that left more than one casualty behind. 15 years later, the Mick and Keith of the band are in very different places. One became a famous guitarist and producer. The other one stopped singing entirely. They meet again in sun-drenched Los Angeles and have one slim chance to recapture what was lost and heal the past, if they can balance their creative and destructive forces and the woman between them, an equal match of their talent and ambition. Rob Yardoumian will be reading and performing songs at Annie Bloom's Books in Multnomah Village next Tuesday, November 12th at 7 p.m. Welcome, Rob Yardoumian.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. That was a great intro. I'm going to hire you to come out with me on the road whenever I do anything from now on.
I'm for hire. I understand that this idea came to you on a morning jog, almost fully realized. And I was wondering, what initially sparked the idea and how did the story unfold in your mind that day?
Well, at the time I was living in Los Angeles, and I lived in a neighborhood called Silver Lake, which is at least partially the same neighborhood where the book takes place. And there actually is a body of water called Silver Lake, and it's a reservoir. There's a jogging path that runs around it. It's about 3 miles around the lake, and I used to run around that in the mornings. I was at a place in my writing where I had finished a collection of stories, and I knew I wanted to write a novel. I had a couple ideas that were kicking around my head. And then one morning as I was running around the lake, you know, so it's like 20, 25 minutes or so of time, and your mind is just kind of freed of stresses and pressures and stuff. And sometimes it just goes places that you're not expecting. And as I was running around the lake this one morning, this idea for this story came to me. And by the time I made it all the way around to the other side, I had the whole arc of the thing pretty well fixed in my head. Now, you know, you hear stories like this, and I'm always really suspicious of them. People are like, oh, that song wrote itself, and uh-huh. I just channeled the muse, and like 10 minutes later it was done, or a poem or a short story. So it wasn't exactly like that. The book certainly didn't write itself, but I had this idea of these two guys reuniting after a long time apart, that there would be a strange personal dynamic between them, something maybe that happened in the past. There would be a power dynamic between them of who had been in charge and now who was in charge. That the record would get done in Los Angeles in the summer in a backyard studio, and then I needed the third leg of a triangle, and so it made sense that the producer half was married, and her wife would be back in that backyard every day as well. And I figured that they would all be sort of in their mid-30s. It would be 15 years kind of since the heyday of their first band. And so that kind of map of the story, I had all of that in my head when I got home that day. Even to the point of, and you know what? I might as well write the songs and make the record too. I mean, that wasn't the main point of the thing. But that was always in the back of my head, that if the opportunity presents itself, you might as well make the record too, because that's even a better story than to say, oh, I was thinking about making the record, but I never really got around to it, so I just did that too. There was one thing that I didn't carry through, that it's in my notes, and I went back and read it a while ago, and at the bottom of the notes it says, there's a magical guitar that was once owned by Buddy Holly that the producer has, and at the end of the book, Riley steals the guitar, or the producer gives it to him, and maybe the name of that guitar is the name of the book. And that idea lasted like 3 hours, and then I was like, okay, that's stupid. I'm not going to do that. But the rest of it pretty much stuck.
So why don't you read the passage that you've selected for us? It kind of sets things off for us.
So I'm going to read just from the very beginning of chapter one, and this is where Riley Oliver, who is our main character, arrives in Los Angeles. So this is chapter one. And so here, finally, washed up at last at the end of the world, Riley took a moment before ringing the bell. This dizzy dream, this headlong plan set to bloom or die trying, 5 days in the car east to west to an address scrawled on a map across the blue Pacific Ocean. To Los Angeles. To Will Taylor. To Will Taylor's house. And so now, here at last, what would he find? On the porch, Riley rolled his shoulders, tapped the cassette in his pocket. The songs are good, he breathed. Let them carry. The front door was graced with a pane of stained glass, the intricate pattern, a treble clef, cut fine in ruby, resting on a sharp black staff, defeating his attempts to peer inside. Riley straightened his hair and the reflection stood as tall as he could. He should have shaved, washed his shirt, that motel back in Needles. Next to the door was a small brass plaque that read Casa de Melodia, the thin black script flowing around the doorbell. He dug his nails sharply into the palms of his hands, 5 seconds, 10, then pushed the button with his thumb. 3 notes chimed away inside. Driving in off highways at last, he'd craned his neck at the impossibly tall and skinny palms, shaggy heads bent inward, murmuring his arrival. And the sunlight, slippery as satin, it introduced itself to everything, the waxed bumpers, the wrought iron gates, shyly, by brushing up against, by furtively draping, the sun a kind of promiser, false-hearted, a hooker in an alley, a guy could pull a quarter from your ear. A fellow traveler, Riley felt, one hand out the window, cupped and warming, as if trapping all the courage in the sky. The last time he'd seen Will, the morning after that lost night, December 8th, 1980, a date you don't forget, obviously, Riley'd said goodbye, turned his collar up against the rain, turned his back on everything, locked his guitar away for a long, long time.
Thank you. So when Riley arrives at their doorstep, that knock on the door changes everything.
It does.
That summer. It threatens all that Will, the producer, and his wife, Lena, have built.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the situation that Riley walks into and how he stirs that up?
Well, he's a bit of a provocateur in general.
Like a lead singer.
Exactly. Yeah, right. He's that guy. So I kind of have a sense that he could walk into a coffee shop and he would stir the place up, you know. But Will Taylor, back in the day, essentially he and Riley had had this band together, and Will was his guitar player. And Will had stuck with it and had moved to Los Angeles and become very successful. And he had this engine going in the backyard there. He had a studio in the backyard. Bands would come in. He would produce them. His wife was the manager of the studio. She sort of filtered out all of the noise that came from the industry folks and from other artists and funneled him a series of really good bands one at a time to produce their albums. And they had had great success at this. And Will wants more than anything for nothing to mess that up. He's become sort of a hermit, a bit of a recluse. He doesn't play live anymore. But in his head all this time, he remembers that voice of that band from that time. He's never had anyone to work with like Riley since then. They haven't spoken in 15 years. Lena has heard of Riley, but she doesn't know the backstory. Will's never told her what happened. So when Riley rings the doorbell without calling, they're in the middle of a busy day. Will's got a band in the studio. Lena's trying to keep things running. He just pops in and says, I got a guitar in the trunk and some songs. And she's like, what, is this the Blues Brothers? We're getting the band back together. He's like, no, I thought maybe we could make my record. So it's a bit of a rocky beginning between the two of them. And then they go back and they talk to Will. And it's a little frosty. It's a little cool at the beginning. But then it begins to thaw over the next week or two as they begin to reestablish those old bonds together.
Riley and Will's interactions in the studio begin to reveal not only their past issues, mm-hmm. but also hint at the future outcome. You do a really nice job with that. Can you talk about what surfaces between them as the men begin to collaborate?
Yeah, there's a lot of history between these two. And, you know, that's a decision you make as a writer when you have because you're the one that knows the whole story, right? The characters know their bits that they were involved in, but you're sort of orchestrating all of it as the puppet master, right? So you have to figure out at what point do you divulge certain pieces of information and how do you parcel that out over the course of 300 pages so that it flows and you're kept interested. There's always something sort of tantalizingly out of your reach that you don't know yet and you don't understand. So these guys have so much buried history between them from what happened before that they can't help but speak to each other in that kind of coded way that best friends always do, that there's little code words and passwords between them that mean something more than just the things that they're doing in the studio that day. But the interesting thing about the two of them is that at the beginning of the story, the power dynamic between them has flipped from the way it was in the old days. Riley was more or less, not necessarily the leader, but he was the singer. He sort of held the lion's share of the songwriting. He was the one who sort of booked the gigs. And now that Will has established himself independently of Riley in this very competitive and difficult world, and he's won Grammys, and he's, you know, people are lining up at the door to have him make their records, he doesn't have to make Riley's record. He doesn't need Riley anymore. So he does him a favor and lets him get a foot in the door. I think that's an interesting question you could ask him at the end of the book, if that was a good decision or not. And I'm not even sure what he would say, based on all the things that happened over that summer. But they both have to come to terms with this notion that it both is what it used to be between us, because it always will be with best friends and old friends who work together, but it's not that anymore. We're not that band, and this is a completely different environment. And there are new rules, and there are things you need to not step on anymore if we're gonna make this thing work. And for Riley, you know, this is a dream for him. He's left his life behind, and he's dreamed his entire life in the background, even though he's not performing anymore, of what would it be like if I hadn't given it up or if I tried it again. So he has to do what Will says at the beginning, and he has to stand in line, and he has to let Will run everything and show up when he tells him to and work on the songs that he tells him to and learn these songs, sing them this way, play them that way. So the dynamic between them is very different in the first sort of third of the book. And there's a lot of kind of reshuffling of those roles that they both have to go through.
Very interesting. We're speaking with Rob Yardumian, a local writer, talking about his brand new debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water. It comes with a CD of original music inspired by this book and written and performed by Rob. We're going to hear from that CD in a little while. One of my favorite, I think my favorite character in this book is Lena, the mm-hmm. wife of the producer Will. And she represents a long-held place of women in rock history. She is a fan who became a nurse healer to a wounded rock star who then becomes a wife and then a business partner. And her husband, Will, clearly respects her. He makes it clear that he needs her and that she gets a vote in all
she
decisions.
Does. That's right.
But ultimately, it's Will's show. Mm-hmm. And that becomes evident when Riley shows up. And although Will doesn't have time for this project, he says, quote, "We're making this record."
Yeah, that's right.
And he calls it special circumstances. So in a sense, this is a shift in the power play within the marriage as well.
A little bit, right.
And those power plays don't come without consequences. can you talk about what the arrival of Riley stirs up in Lena and what events are set into motion?
Yeah, without giving away too many spoilers. so there's two things about Riley, I think, that spark something in Lena over the course of this summer. There's clearly a physical attraction between them, not at the very beginning, but as they get to know each other and spend time together in the house and in the backyard. It's not just physical, but there's there's a dynamic between them that's she likes him and he likes her, and they have a lot in common. So there's that sort of animal attraction between them on the one hand, but more interestingly, I think, is the other side of it, where he shows up at a time when I don't even think she could put this into words until he's been there a while. But it's at a moment in her life where she's ready to make a move and make a change, or at least consider a change. And I don't think she knows that until he's been in the house for a little while, and she watches him on a daily basis, and she thinks about, you know, here's a guy who had a life back in Virginia, where he comes from, who just gave it away and drove across the entire country with a guitar in the back seat and a tape full of new songs and nothing else. You know, he didn't even know if he would get in the door or if he'd be driving back home the next day, you know. So he's a person who's willing to stand on that ledge and face the leap and then take the leap when it's offered to him. Mm-hmm. So both of those things are interesting to her, that he's at a place where he's been given himself this opportunity and he's decided to take that opportunity. So she finds herself at a similar sort of place in her life as the summer unfolds. And so their two paths sort of parallel each other a little bit in this notion of you have characters who may or may not change, so their arc may or may not be resolved, but they've been given the opportunity to change. They've been given the possibility. They're facing something. So, and that's more interesting to me, I think. It's like, it's not necessarily whether you take the opportunity, but that you've been granted that opportunity, and what do you do when that stares you in the face? And what they do with the opportunity ends up being very different. But in that sense, they're paralleling each other. And that's one of the reasons why I gave them both a point of view, so that we could be inside of both of their heads and follow those paths as they work their way through the summer.
Yeah, speaking of point of view, you give Riley a point of view, mm-hmm. and Lena. And then Will's point of view is brought in through flashbacks. Do you mind discussing that a little bit?
Right.
That's a really interesting technique.
Yeah. Well, so I was sitting there and I'm like, okay, I know that Riley is a point of view. He's the protagonist. But I need another one because I didn't want this to all be Riley's book from beginning to end. So there's the three of them in the backyard. There's a triangle. So there's going to be scenes that Riley's not in. And we need to see those scenes. And we can't see those scenes if he's the only point of view. So either Lena or Will needs a point of view. One of them knows the backstory, one of them doesn't. Will obviously knows what happened with the band, Lena doesn't. I think it's more interesting when you have two parallel points of view, one of whom knows the backstory and the other one doesn't. Mm-hmm. So one of them comes into this situation being Riley, and he's trailing a bunch of stuff behind him. All our history dropped down in paradise, he says. And then Lena is reacting to all of this stuff, but she doesn't know anything about what happened back in the past. So you're watching the two of them kind of step around each other in this really charged environment. And then at the same time, they're following their own, as we talked about, their own paths toward changing or not changing. Mm-hmm. And so I liked that notion of the two of them sort of being parallel. And then Will sort of acting as a kind of cipher in the middle, where he's kind of the person that everyone projects their dreams and goals onto. But he's pretty internalized. He doesn't talk a lot. He doesn't lash out. He's not very emotional. He just gets up in the morning and he makes the best record he can make that day, whoever's in, big star, unknown. He doesn't care. He just wants to make a great record. And he's comfortable with that. He's making a good living, and he wants that to continue. So I liked this notion of him sort of being in the center and everybody else kind of spinning around him. Mm-hmm. But what I was missing were two things. One, I was missing his voice. And two, I was missing the details of what actually happened back then.
On that
fateful night.
Yes.
And so I came up with this notion that he would get these little tiny, more lyrical bits that would appear in between the chapters that would take place from his point of view on that night and take us through little tiny impressionistic moments adding up to the story. By the time you get to the end of the book, you learn all about what actually happened back then, and then it kind of colors back against everything you've learned in the present time. So that gave me a way to give all three of them a point of view, but only two of them in present time, because I felt like having all three in present time would be too repetitive.
Well, the suspense in this book is delicious, I must say, and I must compliment you.
Thanks.
Building suspense, and it was amazing. You also did while I'm on the subject of craft, you did a really great job of describing movement.
Hmm.
Very unique, the way the characters moved. You just have a really unique gift in action, which is not always easy. And I also like that you did these really beautiful descriptions, the physical sensations and feelings that occur at the onset of love.
Hmm.
Very nice. I just had to slide that in there.
Oh, thanks.
This book, we're speaking with Rob Yardumian about his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, and it's really cool because it comes with an accompanying music CD, songs inspired by the book, written and performed by Rob. Can you talk about how that came about a little bit?
Yeah, so when I finished the book, I had a little window of time between the time that the book was finished and the time that it would come out. I had maybe 3 or 4 months earlier this year, between like January and April. So, okay, right, you're staring at that time and you're like, okay, this is the period where I need to make the record. But I don't know how to do that. Like, I don't even know where to start. So I got a couple friends and I asked them if they'd be interested in helping me, and they were, which was the biggest step of all. I did a Kickstarter campaign to raise some money, so I made a video, and I shamelessly used my 8-year-old as the star of the video. Which I think was responsible for like 90% of the money that came in, because he's awesome. So we made some money, and which allowed me to pay my guys, my band. So then I went over to David Lane's house. David Lane was the producer, and like list almost any instrument on the record, and he played it except for drums and my guitar. He's a wonderful songwriter and musician and producer. So I went over to his house, and we worked through all the songs, and we recorded the drums, and then we did my parts and his parts, and the whole thing took about 2 months, I guess, which is incredibly rushed. But it didn't feel like it, which is a tribute to David and to his patience with me as not a musician, so not a musician. As I mentioned, I'm a guitar owner, not a guitar player. So there were a lot of moments where I'm sitting there in his little studio and I've got headphones on and he's rewinding the tape and I've tried something 7 times and I can't seem to get it. And he's being very patient. And I'm thinking, I'm Riley Oliver. I mean, this is exactly, and I'm laughing to myself. I can't explain it to him because he hasn't read the book yet at this point. But I'm laughing to myself and I'm like, this is exactly that scene of the guy who's kind of over his head. He's surrounded by professional musicians who are friendly enough. But you know what? There's a clock ticking. There's money happening here. We need to get this take so we can move on. It's late at night. Everyone's tired. So there was a lot of moments like that where, David was always nice enough and said, okay, you're really close. You almost got that. Try it one more time. But we finally got it finished up, and it sounded great, and we got it mastered and duplicated. And so it's really just been a nice little extra piece to the whole thing that I could have, and as time goes on and this particular book passes, I'll always have the book and the record that I did, and I think both of them work together really well, and it wouldn't feel complete to me without both of them. So I really felt like I had to also make the record, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah, it's really enjoyable.
Thanks.
I was wondering, what was your first love, music or writing?
As a kid, it was definitely music, but I didn't start playing guitar until my 20s. I guess I started doing them both about the same time in my 20s. I wasn't one of those kids who had a journal and wrote every day. I'm kind of envious of those people that started writing when they were like 10 or who started playing a guitar when they were 10,
because
they're a lot better than I am now. But I started doing both of them around in my 20s, and I realized really quickly that I was pretty good at one of them and not so good at the other. So in terms of like which one's the hobby and which one's the career path, it was a really easy choice to choose writing.
So Rob, can you tell folks where they can buy your book and where you might be showing up in town in the next couple of weeks?
Sure, got a few things coming up. The book is available anywhere fine books are sold. independent bookstores, as well as online at Amazon and everywhere else. It should be available everywhere by now. So a few things coming up. Let's see. We've got Annie Bloom's here in Portland on November 12th, which is next Tuesday night. And the great thing about that one is, so when I go and do these readings, I've been playing a couple songs, and then playing a song, and then playing another song. And that's been fun and terrifying. But for this one, I actually asked David if he would come and play with me. So he agreed, and I went over to his house the other night, and we drank some beer and worked up a couple little numbers. So he's going to come and join me, and we're gonna play there on Tuesday night. December 3rd, I'm going to be at the Blue Monk doing the soft show reading series with four other fine local readers. And the great thing about that one is they also have artists on hand who illustrate your stories live on an overhead projector while you're reading them,
oh, wow.
Which is really cool to watch. They're like graphic artists who do comic books and things like that. So that's a really interesting little side piece. I can't wait to see what they do for mine. What else did I tell you?
It was the radio.
Oh yeah, we're not doing
I'm
that.
Not sure
so
happening.
The other one that I would want to mention though is I'm also doing a giveaway on Goodreads right now that runs through December 1st, where I'm giving away 5 copies of the book and the CD. So if you're interested in trying to get a copy of both of them for free, which you know is always better than paying for it, you can search for me or for the book on Goodreads and find that giveaway and join. You got about 3 more weeks to join that.
We've been speaking this morning with Rob Yardoumian about his debut novel, The Sound of Songs Across the Water, and the accompanying CD, Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned. I really enjoyed this book.
Thanks.
I really thoroughly enjoyed it. You can learn more about Rob at his website, robyardoumian.com. I'm going to spell Yardoumian for you. Yardoumian. Again, the book is The Sound of Songs Across the Water. Thank you, Rob, for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
I wish you the best as you launch your novel. Thanks also to Laura Stanfill at Forest Avenue Press for hooking us up. Thank you for listening. And now we're going to go out with one of the songs from the accompanying CD, Sing With Me, Brother, For We Have Sinned. It accompanies Rob Yardoumian's book, The Sound of Songs Across the Water. This is Araby.
Dress up in your sister's hand-me-downs. Hey, steal a pack of bones and come uptown. We'll bottle up this kerosene and we'll burn all the churches to the ground. Swallow all this cyanide and make believe that we're the lost and found. But out here it's too cold to remember. Out here it's far. Circus is in town.
45 DJs play
45 RPM records all
day.
Tune into KBOO on November 16th from noon to midnight
for a special 45th anniversary celebration.
DJs will play 15-minute sets of 45 RPM records.
While from noon to 8 p.m., we'll have an open house birthday party at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. With refreshments,
birthday cake, station tours, and more.
So join us November 16th.
In person at KBOO from noon to 8 p.m. and on air from noon to midnight.
To celebrate our 45th year of serving the musical, political, and cultural needs of the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world.
For more information, go to kboo.fm/45rpm2013.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.